This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 17th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to our weekly cinema discussion on the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Today we'll be finding out if all good things do indeed come in small packages as Marvel releases its latest blockbuster, Ant-Man. We'll learn the story of the attempted assassination of Hitler in 13 minutes, and we'll head to rural Italy for a charming coming-of-age film that follows the teenage daughter of a family of beekeepers. A lot of buzz about that one, I'm sure. Apologies. Who better to guide us through these films than the one and only David Jenkins, editor of Little White Lies magazine? You'll be hearing from him right here on the Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show, David. Good to have you with us, as always. Let's begin with the biggest film about the smallest person on the list, though there is a bit of an insect theme, which we'll pick up later. This is Marvel's Ant-Man, which sees Paul Rudd take the lead. Probably better known as a comedy actor, a bit of a stalwart of a number of recent hits. How does he fare as a very, very small superhero?
Well, I mean, this is the kind of... So what Marvel are doing is they've got their serious Marvel movies and their funny Marvel movies. And, you know, this one kind of follows in the template of something like Guardians of the Galaxy, which had the sort of big, you know, it had all the aliens, it had people, things blowing up and people fighting and, you know, all that kind of usual stuff that you get in a Marvel movie. But there were a few jokes in it as well.
Talking raccoon.
Exactly, talking raccoon. And I guess that something like Iron Man would slightly fit into this mold as well. And this is another sort of, you know, they've punched the template again and Ant-Man has fallen out. And Paul Rudd seems to be the perfect protagonist for a movie like this that requires him. I mean, he has his kind of, it seems to be a requirement that you have to have a shot with your top off and showing your kind of, you know, your newly formed six pack. Which, right. Which Chris Pratt famously did in Guardians of the Galaxy as well. So we get to see the Paul Rudd six pack as well. If that's valuable,
that's
for
up a lot of people's
you.
Boulevard. They
yeah,
can,
I mean
they
that,
can
that's
enjoy that.
That's going to be a make or break moment for a lot of people, I think. So yeah, but Paul Rudd does well in this. I mean, I kind of run hot or cold on Paul Rudd. I think he's a bit like. As an actor, I find him a bit like Seinfeld. I don't know if you're a Seinfeld fan.
I was going to say I was a Seinfeld. I am a Seinfeld fan. Yeah. Mm.
But you know how when Seinfeld acts in the TV show where he's like an awful actor, and he's kind of got that kind of perma smirk on his mouth where he's kind of everything is a bit of a joke to him, and I think Paul Rudd has that as well, and I guess that in a film like this that kind of works where he's not taking things too seriously and neither are the filmmakers, so it all kind of fits together.
Now I wonder, Edgar Wright, who obviously a lot of sort of movie aficionados will know and some love, he originally I think sort of proposed this movie, or he was involved in it back in the day, and you imagine he's the sort of director who would bring a that sort of wit, that kind of slightly sardonic side to things, bit of irony maybe, and he'd bring that through. Does that side of things work? Is the wit guaranteed, or they just thought stick Paul Rudd in it, he's pretty funny, that'll do it?
There are some funny bits in it, and it's kind of interesting reading some of the early reviews of the film where people have tried to sort of guess which bits might have been the kind of remnants of Edgar Wright's and Joe Cornish's original script, because on the credits it's got that it's the story is by Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish, but the script is by Peyton Reed, the director, and Paul Rudd. So they've kind of, I guess they've given it a sort of major
overhaul. Yeah.
But I did, it was hard to watch for me to watch the film without kind of trying to second guess what an Edgar Wright version of this movie would have been like, which is a pretty bad thing to do when you're watching a movie.
That's
like
true.
Wishing it was something else. But there are a few moments which you think, oh yeah, that looks like quite Edgar Wright-y. They've kind of kept that in as a sort of nice homage to him or something like that. But I kind of think overall it's very blandly directed, and you watch something, you know, an episode of Spaced came on TV the other day, and you're just watching how the camera zooms around and the edits are so brilliant, and you just think Edgar Wright would have absolutely smashed this movie.
Yeah.
And it would have been one of the great, you know, comic book movies. I mean, again, I'm just second guessing here, but the movie we've ended up with is is fine. It's not gonna be, you know, linger long in many people's memories. And you know, when by the time the next, it'll, you know, nice, it'll hold a beat until the next one comes along.
I think that's a key thing. I was going to ask you about that because, you know, the whole sort of Marvel cinematic, you know, universe has these kind of phases of production. And it's something almost, I don't know, I find it slightly sort of industrial and a bit sort of sinister about it. Is that wrong? I mean, the movie game is a money-making game like any others. I guess it's, yeah, a production line. They've got a format and formula that works. I just find something maybe a little bit sort of joyless about the way they're kind of cranking out these products. Am I just a jaded cynic?
No, I thoroughly concur with you. I have to say, I just, you know, one of the things that I was kind of down on with Ant-Man is that everything about it just felt so familiar. I mean, there were just little kind of beats and story beats and moments and moves that you just felt, I've seen this in all the other Marvel movies before. They're sticking so tightly to this template, and it does make you worry for, you know, doing this kind of production line move, when are things going to get stale? I mean, I think with Ant-Man, the cracks are kind of showing.
Starting to show already.
You know, I mean, this concept of world building is the new kind of buzzword in cinema now. And, you know, you get new franchises like, there's a new Ghostbusters movie coming out, and they've already said that their plan is to make a movie that they can, you know, do spin-offs and create worlds and have minor character spin-offs. And this is what they're doing with the new Star Wars. You know, they're making a new Star Wars trilogy, but there's
something a bit back to front creatively, though, isn't there, about that sort of process, I think. Well, that's what I think anyway.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
People will be able to judge for themselves.
Exactly.
David, that's Ant-Man. It's out in most territories already and will roll out further across the globe until it's everywhere during the summer. Let's move on, David, to a German film called 13 Minutes, which tells the story of a German carpenter named Georg Elser, who attempted to assassinate Adolf Hitler in 1939 during his annual speech in Munich. His plans were thwarted when Hitler, keen to return to Berlin earlier than usual, left the stage just 13 minutes before the bomb went off. It caused huge damage. It caused 8 deaths, but it didn't kill the target. It's directed by Oliver Hirschbiegel, whose last film, Diana, about the late princess. Well, maybe best not to say too much about that one, perhaps. How's he fared with this? Has he done a better job, at least, than with the Diana movie?
Well, I must say, I mean, Oliver Hirschbiegel's probably best known for the movie Downfall, which was the story of, you know, the last days of the Nazi, the Nazi party, set in the Berlin bunker with Hitler and his henchmen, and it caused all those famous internet memes as well, as you probably remember. And this one is, while not quite at that level of interest, is definitely on a step in the right direction from something like Diana, I would say. I mean, just. On a very sort of blunt critical analysis of the movie, yes, there's definitely more of interest. There's more style and verve than there was in the Diana movie, which was, as you say, not you know, let's not go there.
we don't have to slang mud around.
No.
But just tell us about this movie then. So is it a, you know, one can imagine that, you know, the events obviously of that day are, you know, necessarily dramatic. You know, you're watching it in that strange thing where you know what. Obviously, you kind of know what happens or what doesn't happen, as it were. Is it a sort of a slow boil? Is it a bit of a thriller, or is it a bit more of an exposition about, you know, this man and what he means, you know, what he could have been and what he was instead, inadvertently?
Yeah, I guess it is a character study for us, first and foremost. I mean, the structure of the plot is that the explosion and his capture happens right at the beginning of the film in the first 5 minutes. And then he is instantly taken to be questioned and tortured. And essentially, the story is then his flashbacks to, you know, the Nazi officers are basically trying to understand what drove him to do this. And I guess the revelation of why he did it is, well, it takes a long time to come. And it's probably not going to be that big a surprise for most people, considering it's about the rise of the Nazi party in Germany. And I think one of the interesting things about this film, though, it's a kind of element rather than something that it kind of latches onto in a big way, is that Georg Elser worked alone, and he's entirely honest with what he's done and why he's done it. But the Nazi party refused to believe his testimony because it doesn't fit into their kind of grand narrative that there are, like, left-wing
threats on every corner.
Yeah, exactly. And that this was an operation caused by a massive conspiracy rather than just a lone gunman, I guess, and or a lone, you know, bomb expert. So that's where things get quite interesting, where that he's basically, we can see that he's giving them his entire truthful testimony about what he's done and why he's done it, but actually the officers are refusing to believe it, and they basically want him, they're forcing him to admit to something that he hasn't done.
A grand conspiracy on the scale of their own, you know, egos and their own.
Exactly, their own exactly.
Let's have a little bit of a listen. Here's a clip from the film 13 Minutes.
Attentat auf den Führer in München. Eine Bombe. Hallo! Wo will es Sie noch?
Sie meinen, Sie haben Ihr Ziel erreicht.
Der Führer lebt. Ihr Mordanschlag ist gescheitert.
And that sort of had the, you know, the ticking sound effects and the explosive moments. But does the film, it sounds from what you say, it manages to step away from the kind of obvious cliches. It's not necessarily really kind of obvious ham-fisted narrative. It's slightly more thoughtful perhaps than that.
I guess so, yeah. It's not a kind of straight up thriller. I mean, the fact that it has essentially all the action in the first 5 minutes of the film, and then you just have these very slow, quite lethargic flashbacks that are very detailed about, you know, his interactions with characters through the years. And if anything, it's worthy because it's doing that, and it's actually taking a more serious look about the kind of downfall of Germany.
But maybe structurally, it isn't quite on that basis.
You almost, they get to a point where it's almost a bit too serious, and you almost want it to be a little bit more pep and drama to it. Again, it's this kind of nagging thing where within the first 5 minutes of the film, even though you haven't seen this entire flashback, you just, you know, your guess is that he's doing this as a way to get back at the Nazi party. And it basically takes 2 hours to reveal, yes, your initial guess was in fact correct.
That's 13 Minutes, which has already hit the big screen in Germany, comes to UK Picture House cinemas today, and over the next few months will be out in New Zealand, Sweden, France, Netherlands and elsewhere too. David, let's finish with The Wonders, a film about a family of beekeepers in rural Italy struggling to raise enough money to modernise their production process when their life's disrupted by the arrival of a reality TV crew. So many people, I'm sure, feeling empathy with that. The story has a sort of a coming-of-age theme as it follows the elder teenage daughter, Gelsomina. How does this story sort of unfold, David? Is it a coming-of-age drama? Is it a family melodrama? A bit of both?
It's a weird one, actually. It's almost like social realism meets magical realism. So you've got this rural family on this farm, and they are it's a kind of extended family. I mean, what I was thinking of when I was watching it was, do you remember The Darling Buds of May?
Yes.
It's kind of the sort of quite trivial travails of a rural family. They're in honey production. The patriarch is this kind of quite he's a sort of domineering figure. He's unwilling to give in to the sort of technological process, and he wants to keep true to the land and true to the spirit of farming in the area. And I think, you know, he has this large brood of children who all, you know, they're all quite eager to move on and move out and sort of learn about the world, I guess. And their world is sort of slightly turned up. So I mean, it's kind of ironic, really, because the reality TV show that kind of rolls into town is called Most Traditional Family. So on one side, you've got the sort of, you know, the modern world celebrating tradition. So and this kind of leads the family into sort of a crisis, I guess, of what they are, what they're about. Should they be part of this? Are they basically selling out their sort of traditional values for the media and for the modern market? And, you know, I mean, it causes a bit of a, I don't want to say like high drama. It's more like a bit of a kerfuffle, I guess.
Light kerfuffle. That's what you get in these kind of bucolic idylls.
Exactly.
You just get a kerfuffle, not a fully fledged crisis.
Exactly.
Let's hear a little of this one. This is from The Wonders.
C'è un buco nella maschera. Dopo la pizzicano.
Va bene, vai in macchina, Marinella, e non rompe.
Che ci fa?
faccio io qui? Il paese delle meraviglie. Sarà qui. Questo perché?
That's a bit of the Wonders, and there were some nice bee sound effects at the beginning. I'm a big fan of bees as well.
Oh, good.
I just thought I'd share that with you. Do they feature that prominently? Or are they just a byproduct of this family sort of melodrama, or the bees themselves?
The bees,
do they get a bit of credit, bit of screen time.
They do actually. So one of the sort of central set pieces of the film. I want to say this without spoiling it, I think, but one of the young daughters. Her kind of set piece for this program involves bees, shall we say.
Okay.
It's a little kind of skit that she does for the TV, and bees involved on her face. I don't want to say anymore.
I can see where that's probably going. But,
yes.
Well, that's great for a bee.
Yeah,
aficionado like myself.
I mean, I don't know what the official term for that is, but there must be.
It's probably in a lot of medical textbooks, I imagine. But tell me, I mean, it sounds like it's checking a lot of boxes for, you know, the European, you know, a sort of charming European summer movie. Does it fall victim to any of those sorts of cliches, or is it done with a bit of elan and something, you know, a bit of innovation as well?
I think it's kind of it's a sort of sweet little film, and I guess for me it didn't quite it didn't sort of, you know, land its hooks in me, I guess, in that way that I would really need a film like this to. I mean, the director, Alice Rohrwacher, she's this really, really impressive young Italian director. She made this movie called Corpo Celeste in 2011, I think it was, and it was this great debut movie. It was about a young teenage girl. She has this really good, great knack of working with teenagers, preteens, and getting really great, interesting performances out of them. She's less sure-footed in when it comes to creating adult characters. Mm. They always seem the kind of one-note antagonists whose only function in the world is to work against what the kids want to do.
So a counterpoint to the more compelling characters.
So in the clip there, you heard the father's voice, and the real thing that just didn't work for me in this movie was the character of the father, who is just a kind of one-note grumpy, won't give in. No, you don't really empathize for him. His ideas are pretty stupid, and it just slightly brings the whole thing down, I guess.
So a bit of another maybe sort of near miss on our.
Yeah, I think
week.
So. But this has got some lovely moments in it, and one of which is the fact that Monica Bellucci acts as the host of the TV show Most Traditional Family, and she kind of there's this lovely sequence where the family happen across it being filmed in this kind of woodland glade. And Bellucci's dressed as a kind of Egyptian goddess, and it's a very that's the sort of magical realist moment, and it's that kind of classic movie thing where they suddenly realise, oh, it's a TV show, it's not just this magical happening in the forest. But yes, it's got some very charming things in it.
That's The Wonders, which has been hitting the festival circuit pretty hard since premiering at Cannes last year, and is out in UK cinemas now. If you're in Japan, look out this August; it's coming your way. Then that brings us to the end of today's programme. David Jenkins, thank you very much for being with us, as always. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards, thanks to our producer, Holly Fisher. We're back at the same time next Monday. The art newspaper's Jane Morris is here to talk art, of course. But for now, goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.